listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our ongoing coverage of the U.S. attempt at regime change in Venezuela with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. The big story, of course, is still what's been going on in Venezuela, because it's still going on. And
the main thing about Venezuela is that, as we were talking about in our last conversation, the government is very much in control of events inside Venezuela. They're currently, I'm not sure if they've ended, I don't think they have, they're currently holding the biggest military exercises the country has ever seen, in an attempt to make sure that the country is ready for any possible invasion,
right.
Some variant on an invasion.
Which is on the table. The president himself has said, I'm not taking anything off the table.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw today in, I can't remember if it was RT or Hispan TV, but one of those media outlets were reporting that Sergio Lavrov, following up a statement from an earlier statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry, that they believed that the United States had already taken the decision for some kind of military intervention. That was a statement from the Russian authorities last week. Mm-hmm. Just over the weekend, Sergei Lavrov said that the form that this military intervention is likely to take is a kind of camouflage military intervention under the guise of humanitarian aid.
Right.
Now, and that whole area is one that the United States and its Sorry, there's a truck going by. The United States and its NATO allies, Britain and France in particular, of course, but also Germany, Spain, and the others. And they're expert at manipulating their own domestic opinion using pretexts like humanitarian aid. And of course, the attack on Libya and the intervention in Syria is justified under the doctrine of responsibility to protect, which has very little basis in actually in international law.
Right.
But the in Venezuela, the shayline today is supposed to be an important day, but one never knows because one never knows how seriously to take these predictions and threats and ministers coming from the United States government, because the United States government just says what it likes from one day to the next, and it changes its mind from one day to the next. So apparently today they'd scheduled a big delivery of humanitarian aid into Venezuelan territory without the authorization of the Venezuelan authorities, using as cover the spurious claim to a presidential authority of this character Juan Guaido. And we won't know until the news reports come about what has happened, if anything has happened today. But the constant threat is that some kind of attempt to put in humanitarian aid gain entry into Venezuela, in effect, invading Venezuela, supposedly to deliver humanitarian aid, that is, Sergei Lavrov says, that will be the pretext for some kind of military adventure, because United States personnel or other personnel accompanying the aid, if they are in some way attacked by the Venezuelan authorities as they invade Venezuela, trying to deliver on the pretext of delivering humanitarian aid, then the United States will have a pretext to use its own military power.
Yeah, no matter how, I mean, look, there's a million scenarios that they can use for doing this. They can have, you know, somebody that's with a group of humanitarian aid workers shoot one of them and blame it on the Venezuelan military. Yeah. They can have, you know, troops inside the little Red Cross trucks that roll out once they get inside. The basic thing this rests upon is a fake. The only things that are, you know, in dire need, to the extent that there are some things that are in dire need in Venezuela, are things that are being sanctioned by the United States or the result of sanctions.
In particular, medicines, of course.
And by the way, they happen to have, $1 billion here and $10 billion there that they can draw on anytime they like, except that the banks in London and New York won't give the government their own money. And so, you know, the idea, and to cure this problem, they want to send, I think it was a $10 million aid package that they were going to have go across this bridge.
$20 million.
Okay, which is nothing. And then what you do when you're trying to foment unrest, of course, you create a crisis among the population. There's no milk or toilet paper or whatever there is, and then you hand to your own designated agents piles of toilet paper or medicine or whatever the thing it is that's needed, and now suddenly they're the good guy. Look, Maduro took away your toilet paper here. I've got toilet paper for you, etc.
Right. Yeah, and this modus operandi has a very long history on the part of the United States, and drive countries into the dirt and then turn around and say, well, we can rescue you. Yep. You know, and it's like, you know, you deliberately trip somebody up and then say, well, I could help you up if you do what I want.
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, and that, but that's that, that has a, and back in the 80s, it was Mozambique and Angola when the United States was supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Right.
In Central America, it was Nicaragua. It's been Cuba for almost 60 years now.
Yep.
You know, and so There's nothing new about that.
Not even but the players. You still got Bolton, for example. You had Bolton in Nicaragua, you know, 30 years ago, and he's back.
Elliot Abrams,
Elliot Abrams,
who was convicted in, and I think he was pardoned, wasn't he?
He was, yes, he was pardoned. Anyway,
by George Bush, I think.
Senior.
Anyway, and the thing about that is that neither the United Nations nor the Red Cross are willing to participate in that farce.
Right.
So you're, and there was a report today, I think it was in Telesur or somewhere, whereby the United Nations is actually deepening its relationship with Venezuela's legitimate government and its president, Nicolas Maduro. And you have the Red Cross saying that they are not prepared to take part in the proposed U.S. operation because it's not a genuine humanitarian operation.
Right.
So they now, and whatever you think of the Red Cross and whatever you think of the U.N., I don't think very highly of either of those organizations.
Right.
But they are the recognized in generally by the great majority of countries and governments in the world as the legitimate channels for humanitarian aid. And they're turning around and saying they don't want anything to do with the United States initiative because it's not humanitarian.
Right. I mean, as bad as they are, in essence, what they're saying is this is too much even for us.
Yeah. So and that's indicative, in my opinion, Don, that's indicative of a big failure on the part of the United States. They thought that they'd be able to bully and cajole all the usual suspects, including the UN, into supporting what they're trying to do to Venezuela. And so far, they haven't. And that's also part of what we were talking about last week. And because what we were saying last week was that the Venezuelan government continues to be in control of the situation. The economy has not collapsed. And normal life goes on in Venezuela. People go to work, they go to hospital, they go to school, they go to university. Normal life is going on as usual. And all this huffing and puffing by the United States has achieved, inside Venezuela, has achieved absolutely zero. If anything, what it's done is galvanize national opinion against United States policy. I know over the last couple of weeks, there have been at least two polls and by respected polling companies, and both give well over 80% of the population as stating that they're categorically opposed to any U.S. intervention in the country.
That's right.
And then last week, the Hinterlaces opinion poll company, and I think it was on Friday at the or maybe over the weekend, they came out with this poll that precisely reflected the result of last year's presidential election, and that precisely reflected the general balance of political support.
Right.
For the respective players in Venezuela's national political life. And in that poll, 57% of people said that they regarded President Maduro as their legitimate president.
Right.
And I think it was 32% said that they regarded Guaido as their legitimate president. That reflects precisely the balance of political opinion in the country.
Right.
So the great majority, and it's always been like that, ever since the days of Chavez, you know, and it's always been something like 45 to 50, depending on the issue, would always support Chavez or Maduro, and now that Maduro is the president, and around 25 to 30 to 35% would support the opposition. It's always been like that.
That's right.
So What has the United States intervention achieved in terms of influencing political opinion in Venezuela? Precisely nothing.
Right. And the context for that also, people have to remember that the bulk of the media in Venezuela is in the hands of the same oligarchs who owned everything before Chavez and Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution. They still control the bulk of the media. And so the daily harangue on all of these private TV channels in between soap operas and, you know, game shows and stuff, just like here in the United States, the daily harangue is the, you know, the Democratic president, Guaido, and the authoritarian socialist leader, the Maduro, et cetera, just like the U.S. has, bleeding out of the radios and TV sets here. This is drilled into the population's heads. And so that 37%, which is latent in the population anyway, it represents a particular social class, also heavy racial overlays with that, too. You know, it's basically the white upper middle class that's that 37%. They haven't really budged much despite the, you know, the wall-to-wall media blitz.
Yeah, and I think the difference between the United States and Venezuela is that in the United States, the kind of bizarro world, this kind of Alice in Wonderland, back to front, upside down world that is constantly sold to people in the United States, and there most people seem to buy it.
Yeah,
but in countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua, they don't, because most people know very well who the opposition media represent. You know, they and it's the same in Nicaragua, and the most of the or in fact all the printed media and about half of the television media, most of the local radio and cable TV media, and they're all run by the opposition, and people know, right. they know if they're getting a certain message from, say, Channel 10, right. They know that that's an opposition message trying to make them string right. along with what the opposition want. And likewise, they know when they look at when they listen to government media that that's the government message right. trying to persuade them to string along with what the government wants. I mean, and right. people are very aware of that.
Yep.
And I don't know what the situation is in the States, but people seem to be less aware in the United States.
Well, there's more. You've got to, you know, mm-hmm. you get base. People tend to, you know, they'll buy whatever comes out of the box. And tolerate a good amount of cognitive dissonance with reality, but you know, certain basic fundamental realities they speak very loudly inside one's head in the face of propaganda. For example, if you are one of the 2.5 million families that now lives in a brand new apartment that was built by Chavez and or Maduro. In Venezuela, where before you were living in a tin shack, you understand what's going on in Venezuela and who's on which side, no matter what comes out of your television. And you have a constituent, you know, 2.5 million families, you're talking 7-8 million people that with that particular personal experience of the revolution, let alone healthcare, let alone infrastructure, let alone education, all these different things that people have had that they never had before and they weren't even considered worthy of having before.
Right. Right. Yeah, I remember when I lived in Ireland. I remember working with some Sinn Féin activists in an impoverished part of Dublin, and they said, if the ruling class here thought that we could do without houses, and there wouldn't be any council housing, you know?
Right?
And so that's a universal kind of thing. But one of the phenomena that we see here in Nicaragua and also in Venezuela to some extent as well, is that as people get lifted up out of poverty, as they kind of work themselves out of poverty, thanks to support from central government, their expectations increase.
Yep.
And so, you know, that effect that you were talking about, it exists, but it's sometimes it's not as solid as one might think. And of course, that's what the opposition play on.
Right.
And of course, I know that we're drifting off Latin America and the Caribbean, but I remember very well in the late 1970s and early 1980s, the way Thatcherism and I suppose in the United States it was
Reaganism, yep.
seduced people was by encouraging them to pull up the ladder on the people that, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And so people who'd achieved a university education were suddenly encouraged to think it became okay under Thatcher to think, well, people don't deserve free university education.
Right, that's right.
So all the people that got their free university education were perfect. They voted for Thatcher because right. that enabled them to feel superior to
same
the
thing
people
here.
That would no longer have access to university education. So there are all these kinds of phenomenons, socio-psychological phenomena that affect the kinds of developments that are progressive developments that you see in Nicaragua and Venezuela, and they complicate how to maintain the support for the momentum of those programs that are here in Nicaragua have radically changed Nicaraguan society.
Yeah.
And that also is what the United States is playing on with its psychological warfare, of course.
Well, they did that here. See, this is something that there was a point in time when the children of the 60s, quote unquote, and of the civil rights movement and of the anti-war movement went from being groups, you know, and having a sort of a collective perspective on things to being hyper individuals. That, you know, personalized license plates, you know, your own apartment instead of collective living arrangements, your own car, working your way up within the system. In other words, they began to deconnect from everyone around them. And so when that happens, your understanding of the norm changes because what you see around you is less populated, basically. So, you know, if I went to university on a scholarship or free tuition, I'm making $50,000 or $100,000 a year now. Well, gee, there's not really a need for university education to be subsidized anymore because I'm making $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's the norm. I don't know that anymore that it's not, because I've disconnected myself from everybody while I was busy buying another Mercedes or whatever instead of hanging out with my friends and people, you know? And that there's a whole, there was a cultural shift that was induced through the media across the board, music, film, television, popular culture in every way, that went from a collective mindset, which I guess was used to seduce, to draw us in as a generation, basically, and then turned into like basically atomized. And I think there's a correlation between that atomic view and your understanding of solidarity with others, because you start with yourself and your own position as the norm.
Right. And of course, and if you look at places like Argentina, and that is what that kind of phenomenon is what Mauricio Macri played on in order to undermine support for progressive political options represented by people like Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
Right.
So, you know, and while we're talking about Argentina, maybe it's worth looking at another element of the overall U.S. assault on Venezuela, because what they've done is they're systematically trying to discredit progressive policies. So you'll get slogans like "socialism doesn't work," and I when I hear that phrase, I think again back to Margaret Thatcher's election campaign in 1979, when she first became prime minister, and their slogan then was "Labour isn't working." So they were attacking the Labour government because unemployment was relatively high.
Right.
But once she got in, unemployment tripled.
Right.
Right. So and so that's the phenomenon that you had with Mauricio Macri.
Right.
It's the phenomenon that we're seeing in Venezuela. And sorry, not in Venezuela, in Brazil and in Ecuador.
That's right.
And all these governments that got into power on a phony agenda, if they had any defined policies at all, which generally they didn't, immediately turn around and impose extremely right-wing, what are called neoliberal policies, kind of cutting back on government, cutting back on the size of government, cutting back on public sector spending in general, opening up the economy as much as possible to unscrupulous opportunist international capital, and claiming that that is going to, that's the path to prosperity for the country. And in every single case, it fails abysmally on its ostensible terms. Obviously, as you say, it's very successful for, on in terms of its real agenda. And we're seeing that in Argentina. And as you were saying earlier when we were talking before we started recording, and what the United States has done in to promote democracy is ensure that in places like Argentina, Brazil, and Ecuador, and elsewhere, anybody that represents a democratic progressive alternative gets embroiled in the legal system, or if not, imprisoned.
Or bought off in the case of Ecuador.
Yeah, and so and see that you can, if you can bear listening to or reading Juan Guaido's speeches and interventions, you see that in his phony rhetoric that he suggests.
Let me just tell you, I don't know if you saw this. I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is important. I don't know, and if you didn't see this, you need to know about this. Apparently, it's come to light that he went to spend some time in Serbia back in 2005. So he actually was being trained by the same, they call it the Soros people, but basically U.S. intelligence, CIA, the troublemakers that foment absolutely. These things. Yeah,
the same here. And here in Nicaragua, and from something like 2011 onwards, USAID money hasn't been devoted mainly to agricultural extension and the normal issues that development cooperation is supposed to cover, and it's all been for promoting democracy, which and what does that mean? It means training up thousands of young people to become political activists for the right-wing opposition, and that's what the USAID was spending most of its money on in Nicaragua, to the tune of something like $179 million over the last 4 or 5 years.
What's the population of Nicaragua?
6 million.
How much? 100 and what?
179 million.
So it's 30,000 or $30 a person.
Right.
Wow.
So and that, so when you if you listen to Guaido, and he manages all that, you know, and here in Nicaragua, the main front person was a guy called Felix Maradiaga, and he's kind of interchangeable with Juan Guaido, and it's exactly the same lies. I mean, Felix Maradiaga is an extremely violent individual who was actually filmed in Managua working with the delinquents and armed activists that were responsible for so much death and destruction here in Nicaragua between May and July last year, and Juan Guaido's a carbon copy of Felix Maradiaga.
Yeah.
And he's somebody who was involved in extremely violent incidents, I think from 2013 onwards, with the extremely aggressive Popular Will, Voluntad Popular Party. And now he's kind of trying to palm himself off as some kind of peaceful, legitimate, democracy promoting angel,
right?
All the elements that we've been talking about, the abuse of legal and constitutional arrangements that we've seen in Argentina and Brazil and Ecuador, and also to some extent in Colombia, and all those elements are present. The psychological warfare, the threats of military action, and I think you're right, Don, to say that the threat of military action remains very real.
For sure.
In in the case of Venezuela. But what form that military action will take, one can't really know. And to me, it's not at all clear that and I've said this from the start when we started talking about the intervention, the current intervention in Venezuela, the latest phase of it, because it's been going on since, 1999?
Yeah.
This latest phase, I continue to believe that the main question is what kind of defeat the United States will suffer.
Right, that's exactly right. You know, this kind of crazy project may be part and parcel of some realistic thinking along those lines on their part. In other words, they see direction, the historical bend that is behind them, and you know where they're headed, and they're trying to figure out what kind of a landing to have, basically, whether right. it's a soft landing, a hard landing, a high impact explosive landing. They seem to be now with Pompeo, who, by the way, is supposed to speak with Lavrov later today, Tuesday the 12th, right. And Bolton and that whole crew, or if Trump reaches back into his campaign rhetoric, which he acknowledged, by the way, in an interview a week ago Friday for Face the Nation on CBS, that I ran on the platform of ending these wars and no more regime change, and I meant it, he said, and the CBS interviewer who was trying to goad him on about Syria and such said, yes, you did. So that's there, too. Who knows how that's going to all resolve, but we're going to have to come back to this next week because we're just about out of time.
Okay, Don. Well, thanks for inviting me to talk, and let's see how things develop over the next few days.
Yeah, and maybe we could go a little deeper into what happened there last year in Nicaragua and draw a couple of, maybe take a look and see if we can flesh out some other similarities.
There's plenty of parallels with Venezuela.
Cool, very good. Okay, thanks a lot. This is their MO, so maybe we can draw a little picture of it. All right, thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After a rather bumpy rollout, the new Green Deal is upon us. Co-sponsored by Democratic firebrand Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the plan foresees a radical restructuring of the American economy and how people will live. What the plan does not address is how much it costs. How much will we have to go into the red to become green? Crosstalking the Green New Deal, I'm joined by my guest, Christopher Niewiem in Washington. He's a Republican strategist and founder of the Niewiem Group. Also in Washington, we have Christopher Barron. He is president of Right Turn Strategies. And in San Diego, we cross again Silverstein. He's an international energy and environmental journalist for Forbes and other publications. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Chris, let me go to you first here. I read the American Conservative and came across Pat Buchanan's reaction to the Green New Deal, and he said, "Well, let me just give you the title: the Green New Deal is a suicide note for Democrats." Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I do think that it's going into that very far, hard left precinct that I think Republicans want to paint the Democrats in order to kind of push them off the radar from the independent votes they need that they were not able to secure last time. So pretty harsh characterization, but I would tend to agree with that. And I don't believe that, and now they're trying to sort of distance themselves saying, well, it's just an idea, it's not really formal policy yet. But I would agree that it is very far left. They're going to have a hard time dealing with it. And notice, two key Democrats lately have kind of had their head slapped by Nancy Pelosi in regards to Ms. Cortez as well. So I think there is a little bit of distancing going on in the Democrat caucus in Congress.
Okay, Ken, in reading this non-binding resolution, I was just struck how it's trying to solve all problems all at the same time. I mean, over the years, even members of the GOP do recognize the importance of global warming and what strategies should be applied. I mean, as a conservative, I can talk very easily to progressives. We agree on the problem. We don't agree on the solution. That's the problem here. But in reading this this resolution, I almost left speechless like I am right now. I mean, this is going to change. What they want to do is change the entire fabric of the country. Isn't this going too far? Go ahead, Ken.
I think that you've misrepresented it, Peter.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I disagree with your premise that it's a radical solution to a problem. The premise is that global warming,
shutting down air travel is not radical.
Keep going, Ken.
The premise is that if global warming is an issue to be dealt with, then here are the solutions we need to keep in mind. And it just speeds up what's been a green energy evolution. It doesn't change things radically at all. It just now the cost will be an issue, but the sponsors of this say that the cost of inaction is even higher.
Okay, I've heard that argument here. Let me go to Christopher. I mean, let's examine some of the words, the phrases in this here. The Green New Deal. The authors say stopping current, preventing future, and repairing historic oppression of indigenous peoples, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialization communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, the low-income workers, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities, and youth. I mean, what percentage of the population is this? I mean, this is 50 years after the Great Society. It looks like half the population is under oppression. Go ahead, Christopher.
This is so insane. Like, I actually feel bad for people who are forced to defend this because this is sheer lunacy. Look, I've worked for three former members of Congress. This is not how the process works. This is not how things are done. This isn't a serious proposal. I mean, we can have a discussion about global climate change, which I believe is real. And I believe that, you know, we do have man-made contributions to it. But what the hell does that have to do with full employment for everyone, with guaranteed housing for people, with guaranteed health care for people? We're not even talking about global climate change. We're talking about a smorgasbord of, and everybody gets a unicorn. I mean, it's literally the kind of thing you would hear in a junior high school, you know, race for class president. Like, I promise everyone we're getting Coca-Cola vending machines, you know, in every corner. Like, it's just not a real proposal. And the way that it was rolled out is so ham-fisted and so embarrassing. I can't believe there are any Democrats out there who want to put their name on this.
You know, Chris, even within the non-binding resolution, it makes reference to the New Deal of the FDR era. And I would question the parallels. I mean, first of all, the New Deal didn't end the Depression. The Second World War did. I mean, technically, if you look at the indices, it was 1943, okay, 2 years into the war. Also, FDR didn't inherit these monster deficits. And thank goodness the Republican Party has to reassess this. They after 2 years of having control of the Congress, they did absolutely nothing. Shame on them. But we still have these deficits. How can we even think about a plan that will remake America in every single possible way with these deficits? Go ahead, Chris.
That's right, Peter. Well, first of all, once I get into Congress, we're going to fix all this. Don't worry about it. But, you know, I think in terms of the New Deal, it's in terms of scope, there's similarities. In terms of scope, in terms of doing big, broad, new things, there are similarities between the Green New Deal and back when President Roosevelt. The difference is President Roosevelt knew how many branches of Congress there were, or chambers of Congress, unlike Ms. Cortez, who, frankly, I said, don't call her the village idiot, don't call her the village idiot, but I'm going to call her the village idiot. It is inspiring that people can rise to office. That's a good thing. But when you get to this level, you don't understand government, you routinely misspeak, you don't understand economics, and to agree with Christopher, I completely agree. What the hell is paycheck unfairness? I mean, this is absolute unfettered socialism. It's going to fail, and the Democrats know it's going to fail, which is why now they're trying to play a whole bunch of different games. Look, you know, whether it's the sweeping legislation here or, you know, border security policy, they are as far left as they come. We've seen what happens in far left governments. It doesn't work. It's not going to work here. And I hope that Ms. Cortez can figure out how many branches of government there is before her next interview.
Okay, Ken, I mean, there is a consensus among us here that we have to deal with a changing environment, okay? And we've already had an admission here that global warming is real and it is a man-made, man is part of that problem. We all have consensus here. But when you have this plan come out, doesn't it really belittle the position that you might have on the environment? Because, how many people have I come across in the last 48 hours that just said this is like a cartoon script? I mean, doesn't it denigrate and belittle people like yourselves that support more government intervention to deal with these problems? Because I think it makes a mockery of it. Go ahead, Ken.
I think you guys, quite honestly, are going way overboard in terms of your description of the objective of this plan. So there's a lot to unpack in what's been said. For starters, the Obama came into office in 2008 under the new energy economy, and this is merely an extenuation of the new energy economy, which has helped reshape the American economy. The American economy is really transitioning from the industrial age to the digital age, and this is a catalyst to help propel that.
Yeah, okay, but Ken, let me jump in here. But if you're saying this process is going on right now, why do we need the government to do it? Why don't we just let it happen? Well, okay,
that's a great question. You read the piece that I wrote in Forbes. I mean, the free market is working. I mean, the wheels of the free market are already in motion. Natural gas is replacing coal. Wind and solar energy are becoming cheaper and better, and getting more and more market share. All this does is aim to accelerate the progress a little bit. And there is one other.
How does guaranteed housing for everyone have anything to do with climate change? Like, I know that you want to try to dress this up and you want to try to make this seem like a reasonable proposal. But the fact is, stop gaslighting people. The actual language of this resolution is completely and totally off the rails. Like, we don't even need to get in to the FAQ that they released afterwards, which then they pretended like it didn't happen, it was doctored, no wait, it was accidental, we still don't have an FAQ up now. I mean, this stuff is not mainstream. If you want to have a discussion about a green economy, that's great. About new technologies, that's great. About stopping global climate change, that's great. If you're then going to have a conversation about how are we going to afford to guarantee housing for every man, woman, and child in this country, guaranteeing health care for every man, woman, and child in this country, guaranteeing jobs, like, that's not a conversation that can all take place at the same time.
Let me jump in here, because it's three against one. I want to go back to Ken here. Ken, I mean, and I'm not trying to be facetious here, and I want Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to succeed. I think, you know, let her put her case out there. But in reading this document, isn't it just really one big form of virtue signaling? It would be nice. But it doesn't have any details how we'll get there. Go ahead, Ken, before we go to the break.
Well, I mean, I don't dispute the fact that, this is not the end all be all to the resolution of all mankind's problems. I mean, I'm not sure that that's the takeaway. But if that's your takeaway, I'm not going to argue with it. The only other point I want to make is that when you go into some of these distressed communities, as I have, such as in southern West Virginia in Appalachia, where the coal industry has been decimated and the people there live in abject poverty, and the opioid addiction is just over the top. The notion that
because Democrats put them out of work.
All right, I'm going to jump in. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Green New Deal. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to the great city of San Diego. Ken, you wanted to finish your thought before we went to that hard break. Go ahead.
Yes, which has tremendous bipartisan support, is to have public investment in these communities that have been sort of left behind by the digital revolution. And that includes, the coal regions of Appalachia. It includes the one that the congresswoman represents who helped author this thing. So public investment in these areas that have been left behind has bipartisan support. And so if you start putting 21st century energy investments in these regions, that's a good thing. That means jobs. That means opportunities. That means an advancement of the energy costs.
Yeah, but Ken, I don't think anybody here on this panel or most of our viewers probably would disagree with that. I just don't understand why this all-encompassing plan is supposed to fix all problems. Let me go back to Chris in Washington, D.C. I mean, I lived in Eastern Europe in the 1980s, communist Eastern Europe, and they had five-year plans. And this sounds like a 10-year plan, okay, where everything is managed by the federal government, makes all of the decisions here. I mean, every single household will have to be refitted. Airplanes essentially going to be banned, but I'm sure the rich will still fly to Davos. I mean, this is central planning. I'm sorry. That's exactly what it looks like to me. Go ahead, Chris.
Peter, honestly, I just want to turn over all my life's decisions to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I want her to handle my finances, my job. I don't want to ever make another decision again. I want the village idiot to make it for me. Look, I think Ken sounds much more rational on this. I think the way that he's talking about investment makes sense. But Ken, I hope, would admit, this isn't the Ken plan. This is the far left hard plan of trying to use those understandable investments in terms of energy and modernization to push a far left, hard left agenda of diminishing our military, diminishing our greatness in the world, and trying to take over the economy. Here's the problem with socialism at the end of the day for me. And yeah, people can say there's socialist tenets in the way we budget things. Sure, we've got entitlement spending. We've got these things. Here's the difference, though. We still have free markets, and we still have checks on that. Once you give away your power to a central government, you're not getting it back. And that's the difference that these far-left Democrats don't understand when in the bubble in Washington, now that they're part of the swamp, making it worse. So that's my big concern, is that they don't have it's dressed up like a modernization plan, but really it's a far-left plan by the village idiot, and I don't think it's going to work.
Well, Christopher, I mean, in reading it very carefully, there's a huge injection of what we call identity politics. Now, are we going to legislate that into law, identity politics? I mean, that seems like it's ramming it down the throat of people. Actually, it kind of reminds me of the Patriot Act. Nobody read it, but they voted for it. Obamacare, nobody read it, but they voted for it, okay? This sounds like deja vu all over again for me. Right now, it's a non-binding resolution, okay? And it doesn't have, it's just bones out there of virtue signaling. But when you inject, want to legislate into law identity politics, I think we're going down a very bad path if that's the intent. And it certainly looks like it to me. Go ahead, Christopher.
No, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I want to give Ken credit because he's done a great job of putting lipstick on this pig. The reality is I happen to live in one of those depressed areas that he's talking about. I live on a mountain on the border of Virginia and West Virginia. And the very people that he's talking about that we need to be helping, I agree with. But guess what? In my precinct, 76% of those people voted for Donald Trump, and they support Donald Trump. And these Democrats who are signed on as co-sponsors of this Green New Deal spend almost all of their time demonizing those people. The only people they don't talk about in this document is the people who happen to disagree with them, those rural Trump voters. They have spent the last 2 years demonizing those people. So you can forgive me and my neighbors if we don't take this as a sincere, you know, legislative effort to try to help those people in those areas. It's not. It is lipstick on the pig. Appreciate the nice soundbite, but that's not what this is about.
Okay, you know, Ken, now we're going to get into how much is it going to cost? Okay, let me point out something that's going on as we speak right now. We have this yellow vest movement in France. And essentially, it was the spark that started all of this is that the government brought into force a fuel tax that affected the rural areas, working people that use their cars. And now Macron's popularity in this country is at 20% at best here. It seems to me, again, reading this non-binding document, you're basically going to ask the interior of the country, the people rely so much on their cars and their equipment that creates emissions, you're going to make them pay the highest price, okay? Because, well, the rich and fortunate always seem to get around all of these things. Everybody else has to pay for it. People that are least able to pay for it. Go ahead, Ken.
I'm sort of dismayed that the whole proposal has been lampooned before it's even got out of the starting gate, at least by your side of the aisle. Everybody here knows the legislative process and how it works. You know, these people, they weren't very, they didn't put a lot of detail into their proposal. It is just an idea to start a debate. It's not, here is our idea, take it or leave it. Everybody knows that the President of the United States is a Republican. The U.S. Senate is dominated by Republicans. So the idea, even in general, is not going anywhere. But it is, all it does is try to advance the notion that as a country, the United States ought to invest more in 21st century technologies that can help mitigate climate change.
But then you would agree with me,
but
Ken.
Hang on here.
Okay, Ken, then you're agreeing with me that this is just an act that is virtue signaling. That's all it is. Okay, this is a proposal. It has no detail. It really isn't really logical. It's a wish list. It's hopeful. But that's not a very good political tactic. Again, I think it undermines the good work of people like yourself that are trying to bring attention to these things.
I disagree with you, Peter.
Go ahead.
You have a whole show about this topic.
Yeah.
So people are talking about it. People are debating it.
People are making fun of it.
Well, no, I mean,
not favorably.
Congress people propose it, go public with it. You have five presidential candidates instantly back it up. Did they even read it? Did they even ask any questions? Yeah, I'm doing a program on this. I think it's really important. Christopher, jump in.
It's like a political hostage situation going on in the Democratic Party right now. The truth is this is nuts, and this is insane, and it's not us lampooning it. They lampooned themselves. I mean, this proposal is not serious. It's ridiculous. It's a wish list. And the fact that there are so few Democrats willing to say, yeah, climate change is important, and a new economy, green economy is important,
agreed,
but this kind
agreed,
of stuff is
agreed,
pie in the sky. This,
agreed,
this isn't realistic, that no one will speak up about it.
Okay, Chris, I mean, let me go back to Chris here. I mean, it seems to me when we look at the reaction of Speaker Pelosi, which I think she probably has very strong feelings about AOC. And you know what? I mean, what's happened here is that Cortez, she's turned into the wedge for all of this, because, of course, if you turn on Fox News, she's their darling because it's a wedge to divide the Democrats. Now, the Democrats, because of the virtue signaling, I'm sorry, Ken, I'm going to stay with it, they're being pulled radically to the left. Is that really where they want to go? Go ahead, Chris.
Not if they want to win. You know, and in brief, you know, when you mentioned the Patriot Act, the acronym stood for Providing Adequate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. The reason I mention that is most people in Congress didn't know what the acronym meant,
yep,
much less read the bill, and it had sweeping effects. Same thing here with the Green New Deal. I don't think they're going to win. You know, there's a lot of hypocrisy that President Trump has been able to hit them so hard on. They're having a hard time. Nancy Pelosi has walls and armed guards around her house, but she doesn't want it for the country. They don't want to lose their own political capital, but they want to be able to have these other ideas out there. So they're in this position of empowering the energy, as Nancy Pelosi says, of new ideas. But when they hear how stupid the ideas are, that's when they start to backtrack. So yes, it's an idea. Yes, they're just expressing expressing themselves, but they're in a position where when it comes down to policy, they're going to have to kind of work through those things. I don't think they're prepared to do it. And I also think that some of these messages that they're using are not working. When you look at the crowds Donald Trump has, and then you have demagogue Beto O'Rourke, who should have had his rally in Mexico if you want to represent foreign interests. So I think that there's a lot of they're really struggling lately. And frankly, you know, like the president said, you know, I would love for some of these folks to run. It's going to get a lot more exciting.
You know, Ken, on top of the fact that if we're going to make it partisan here, I am not a Republican. I'm a conservative. OK, you know, considering how the left champions open borders and then you have a layover of this green revolution, as it were. So you're going to have everything is free for everybody and you have open borders. I mean, how in the world is it sustainable when everyone will be able to come to enjoy the fruits of this amazing green revolution that the left seems, or members of the left seem to support? I mean, it's ludicrous, isn't it? Go ahead, Ken.
No, you guys, I think we just come at it from two different places. I mean, I don't even understand half the crap that you guys are even saying. It's just because we run in two different
circles. That's because you're in California. That's probably why it doesn't make any sense.
I don't watch Fox TV, so I mean, I just don't quite understand the mindset that you described.
Did you read the proposal?
Did you read
the proposal?
But Ken, what I think we're saying on this program, maybe we are really going at cross currents here. What you've written, what you think, and some of the policy prescriptions you propose, I agree with. I like that, okay?
Right. That's a reasonable
conversation. What this document is written by the high school socialist club, okay?
Okay, so let me just say one thing again. So, and I've been covering this beat for 20 years.
And that's why we have you on.
When Obama came to office and pumped in $1 trillion in a stimulus plan to create the new energy economy, he also was called socialist. Today, the new energy economy, by all standards, even by the standards of this show, has become mainstream. That is, climate change is accepted as real, that wind and solar energy.
Ken, we've run out of time, but I want to have you back on the program to continue this discussion, okay, as it moves forward. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in San Diego. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.